This session is on Rites of Healing by Rosemary Ruther. I'd like to start out saying a little bit about healing in the Christian tradition. Needless to say, healing is a very important part of the gospel ministry of Jesus. Jesus is seen as a very essential part of his ministry, and in effect as one of the signs that he is the Christ and that he represents the signs of the presence of the kingdom is healing. And healing is both healing from physical infirmities and what we today might call mental distress, what antiquity tended to think of as demonic possession. So Jesus is seen constantly in that role as a healer, freeing people from all kinds of distress of mind and body. And you remember the passage in several of the Gospels that talks about where the message comes from John the Baptist to ask if he is the one or should we look for another. And the answer is, you know, not to present his theological credentials, but precisely to present the signs of healing. You see that the blind see, the deaf hear, the lame walk, the poor have the good news preached to them. And so that, you know, that is the response to the question, are you the one? Or shall we look for another? And certainly in early Christianity, first centuries and so on, even, I suppose in the Middle Ages, ideas of healing continued and were often associated with holiness. Saints, particularly, were thought of as having gifts of healing. It seems to me that, a lot of that notion of healing as a part of the ministry of the church has tended to disappear in the last 300-400 years. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that in sort of mainline, let's say mainline Protestant traditions or even mainline Catholic traditions. I think, first of all, that healing came to be associated with the miraculous in the sense of miracles as over against what is natural. kind of dualistic notion that some things are natural and other things are miraculous. And healing was thought of as the miraculous. And so from the point of view of modern rationalism, it was thought of as in effect superstition. And certainly in some of the places where miraculous healing has been continued to be a strong tradition, it has certainly seemed to be a superstition, if not in some cases charlatanry. One reacts with some dubiousness about the great crowds that go for healing to pilgrimage sites such as Lourdes in France, or the kind of Pentecostal healing rites where all kinds of people get up and testify that they have been miraculously healed from all kinds of, evils such as cancer or broken legs and so on. And so that, I think that kind of notion of, the miraculous is something that us rationalists, with our division between the natural and the supernatural, or the natural and the unnatural, have a hard time dealing with, and tend to marginalize that kind of healing from our Christian traditions. It seems to me that what our notions of healing have become in modern times has been very much, as we rationalists want our healing to be within the framework of the bounds of nature, natural law. And so if we have some kind of, we sort of compartmentalize healing. Spiritual stuff goes to priests and pastors, psychological stuff goes to psychologists, physical stuff goes to doctors. And so we kind of compartmentalize ourselves into these kind of parts and have these different specialists that we use for these different aspects. if you have some kind of physical distress, you tend to end up with a specialist. Once you have a tennis elbow, you go to an elbow specialist, and you discover that this particular doctor usually doesn't know anything about any other part of the body, and so that you have a kind of compartmentalization of medicine in terms of the specialist. So even the body isn't sort of conceived of as a total organism, but it's thought of that, you know, there's a specialist who knows about ankles, but, you know, please don't tell me anything about feet, because I don't know anything about feet, I just don't know about ankles, and so on. So that kind of specialization is part of a compartmentalization. And not only do specialists tend not to have any real sense of the body as a total organism, but certainly not to want to deal very much with how the psychological and the physical interconnect, and certainly not how anything that has to do with the spiritual might interconnect with physical and psychological distress. So I think all of that kind of plays into our inability to kind of integrate healing. But certainly the need for that kind of perspective on healing seems to me to be all the more evident, and perhaps precisely because we don't have a good healing ministry in many of our mainline churches. People flock to some of the farther fringes of Christianity, if not other kinds of religions. I think there's been various kinds of protests against that in recent times. One kind of protest, I think, is kind of a holistic health movement. And we've got a little bit about flowing around about that at Holden in terms of foods and really thinking about how foods affect your health, being aware of things like additives and all this kind of thing. So a much more of awareness of food and exercise and all those things, and thinking of your body holistically rather than sort of paying attention to isolated fragments of the body. I think another kind of movement, which I think is very important, is women's health movement. That began in the 60s and came out of a suspicion of certain women that the dominant male medical practice, there's even been books called Male Practice, sort of a pun on male malpractice, had certain kinds of lack of sympathy for women. And I could illustrate that in a number of ways. There's been a great deal of literature in that area of the women's health movement. Are any of you familiar with some of that literature? There's been quite a lot of books written, both on the historical aspect. Women in most traditional societies, in fact, were the major healers. And was most sort of day-to-day healing was in the hands of women. Women were, in traditional societies, the herbalists. Even in the 18th or early 19th century, most housewives had a lot of remedies that they knew. A colonial housewife would have an extensive herb garden, and she would know about, in other words, she would be growing a great many of the medicines for her family from her herb garden. So women just traditionally played much of the kind of ordinary medicine was a function of the mother and wife, and came out of a whole kind of lore that was passed down in the family, and particularly mothers and daughters, about various kinds of healing herbs. Of course, women did most of the midwifery and all that kind of stuff. And much of the triumph, you might say, of university medicine in the Middle Ages and early modern period, university medicine that was in the hands of males was really only available to an elite. And it's only recently, roughly the last 100 years, that a kind of university medicine has kind of taken over as the only legitimate medicine and driven every other kind of medicine out of the field as being illegal or illegitimate. And anybody who practices and that dominant kind of medicine, it seems to me, has an overwhelming bias in two directions. Its bias is toward medication and surgery. It's a pill-pushing, sort of knife-cutting type of medicine. it's not, shouldn't surprise you too much that one of the key groups of people that went into surgery, in fact, one of the early guild for surgery was the barbers and surgeons. So it sort of came out of that particular guild. And they were among the first to kind of try to push out women as midwives and to the first obstetrical tools, for example, were only allowed to people who had were part of this barber and surgeons guild, and women weren't allowed to join that, and so of course they couldn't use these tools. So there's a very interesting history in terms of the kind of marginalization, both of home medicine, women's medicine, and various alternative kinds of medicine in favor of what has become the dominant medication and surgery type of tradition. So part of, I think, the holistic medical movement has been an effort to recover various alternative kinds of medicines and a whole new interest, for example, in herbal aspects of medicine and so on. After you have to remember that most medications are a kind of chemical substitute for herbs. So as I said, the women's health movement has, one aspect has been a kind of historical research on this history of the triumph of one particular kind of medicine. It also has looked at a number of areas where it has thought the dominant medicine, dominated by a certain kind of male university education, a male university education from which women were basically not allowed to join until fairly recently. There were few women toward the end of the 19th century that were allowed to go to medical schools, but that kind of medicine has been very much a male preserve, and women really have not been very, very welcome in it until maybe the last 20 years. Women have been making some inroads into becoming doctors, but even women who tried to become doctors in the 40s and 50s found that the club was set up in certain ways to make it very hard for them to succeed. So they've been looking at certain kinds of biases. For example, one area is the tendency to dismiss various kinds of distresses of women as simply, it's all in your head, and the response is essentially sedatives. So a kind of over-medication of women, particularly middle-class women, who are the primary people who can imbibe such medicine, so to speak. A kind of over-medication of women with sort of antidepressants and that kind of stuff, rather than kind of taking these things seriously as signs of real distress that need to be looked at much more deeply, when you kind of just push a little Valium onto them or something like that. I think another area that has been examined is over sexual surgery, unnecessary hysterectomies, unnecessarily radical mastectomies. There's been a lot of some questions about that. I think another area is the kind of birth control that has focused primarily on, shall we say, controlling the female reproductive system rather than looking at possible male birth control methods. And Mary Chandler has an excellent little song she could play on this subject, but she could play that afterwards. It's called the IPD rather than the IUD. It kind of satires the whole way in which, you know, you kind of casually say, well, you know, only 10% have died. I mean, that's a pretty good average and so on. But 10% were too depressed. I mean, there's been a number of scandals, such as the Dacan shield, which was a intrauterine device that was sort of pushed in the early 70s, and there was an enormous amount of infections and deaths that came from that, and quite an unwillingness for a while to take seriously the questionableness of that and pull it off the market. birth control pill, when it was in its rather early crude stage, was extensively tested on Puerto Rican women. So the kind of use of poor populations to test questionable things, that's a whole other area that I think has been looked at. Over-medication in childbirth, treating childbirth as though it were essentially a disease, and so the mother is thought of as a kind of a patient to be knocked out and laying flat on her back, and then you deliver the child as though it were a surgical operation, instead of recognizing that childbirth is not a disease, it's a natural operation, and that that you ought to think of the mother as essentially the birth giver, the one who is an active agent in birthing, and the doctor is there to help in a natural process in which the mother is the actor, the agent, rather than the doctor as, you know, doing something analogous to a surgical operation. And so there's been a lot of whole movements around natural childbirth. So I'm just kind of reminding you of some of those that I'm sure you've heard of. I think another area that spun off of that is what I would call the women's spirituality movement. And the women's spirituality movement, I think, has a lot of interest in healing. And that's where I think it flows into areas of liturgy and worship, but various kinds of meditative, both individual and group meditative practice that really try to get at, you might say, the deep connections of our physical, mental, and spiritual well-being. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about ideas of rites of healing that might flow out of small communities, supportive communities, or certainly could be practiced in some larger, you know, regular local churches, if those regular local churches had a strong sense of being a supportive community. I mean, some do and some don't. Whereas I think any of these kind of rites of healing and so on that I'm talking about presuppose a kind of a strong supportive community, and maybe some local churches might function that way. In some cases, we might be looking at it. At a smaller support group that might gather around a person in a particular moment of distress. Now, some of that, of course, we get at in ordinary Sunday worship by having prayers. When we talk about, you know, prayers for intentions, and people might pray for, you know, prisoners and jails in South Africa, and somebody else might pray for, you know, my friend Mary, who is about to have an operation. And so all kinds of, you know, a kind of aspect of prayer for physical or even mental distress comes into those kind of prayers in Sunday liturgy. But usually the person who's being prayed for isn't there, which is all right. I mean, one is sort of mobilizing a certain praying community for a certain intention. But that's a little different from a prayer support community gathering around a person who is there and really engaging in some kind of prayer service around a person or persons who are there. Now, the kind of healing liturgies that I'm thinking of are, I mean, I'm not thinking of any of us being saints and being able to perform miracles, although perhaps we should think that all life is a miracle. In any case, none of us have produced our own lives. So some of that kind of rigid line between what is natural and what is miraculous is to a certain extent, I think, the arrogance of a modern rationalism that assumes that it knows the line between this is natural, this is in our control, and this is outside and probably doesn't exist. If we start thinking in a sense of all life as miraculous, all life as a gift, then some of that kind of notion of knowing exactly the limits begins to become a little bit more questionable. But I'm thinking of simply drawing, in a sense, that the kind of healing I'm talking about in support communities, you might say, draws on the miracle of ordinary life, the miracle of ordinary grace, if you might put it that way. the miracle of ordinary grace means that, first of all, that we have much more reserves for renewal of life in our own being than we realize. Because we live out of a very small part of our being. And there's a much greater reserve of our being that we don't tap into. And I think that's again part of our present socialization, that we draw on a narrow segment of our total potential. John Schramm alluded to that last night when he talked about singing as coming from the right brain. Some of the modern research, brain research, has discovered what a kind of complex and marvelous instrument the brain is. The brain is very flexible, expansive, and so on. And that we usually are using quite literally only a small part of our brain. And particularly, it has become aware that certain kind of functions tend to be located or develop in certain parts of our brain. And much of our rational education draws on only a certain sector of what's been thought of as the left side of the brain. And that much of particularly the right side that is the seat of the more intuitive and poetic functions is really quite literally very underdeveloped. And one of the intriguing things is to discover that singing and music and so on is primarily a right brain function. So quite literally, people might have a damaged left side of their brain and be unable to speak, and yet can still sing, because there's a whole other part of the brain that is available, so to speak. When I was a teenager, the son of one of my mother's friends who was a rather brilliant mathematician and scientist, and he was really expected to be quite proficient in that area, but he was drafted into the Vietnamese War and had left side of his brain severely injured and was picked up on the battlefield and expected to die. But he survived, and the Army Medical Service began to train him to use the right side of his brain. I have no idea what that means. I just remember hearing that they had worked with him to train him to sort of transfer over functions to the right side of his brain. And so he gradually learned to talk and so on, and to function. But what's interesting, and I didn't even realize the significance of this till much later, is that the damage to the left side of his brain meant that he never really recovered the same capacity to do science and mathematics. But what emerged as he began using the other side of his brain is a whole other capacity for art that he didn't know he had. And so he ended up being an architect rather than a scientist. It was he sort of developed a whole other capacity, which he didn't even know he had. So I'm suggesting perhaps that liturgy and healing liturgy, you might say, taps into some of that unused potential that we often don't deal with. Certainly we don't deal with in physical medicine, but we also often don't deal with in what I call talk therapy. Because a lot of the psychological therapy, and let me say that I'm not simply bad-mouthing physical or psychological healings. I think all of those have their function and place. But simply suggesting that there are other dimensions that we have left unexplored, and that liturgy and song and prayer and so on tap in to this aspect of our potential that has tended to be very underdeveloped. I think another aspect of healing liturgies draws on the kind of healing that comes from this supportive, affirmative community. That there's a kind of healing that comes from being able to share verbally or even non-verbally certain kinds of distresses, and to have a community gather around you, lay hands on you. I think the laying on of hands is really the you might say, the key ritual for that kind of healing that connects spirit, mind, and body. So very appropriately, there's a kind of role for the laying on of hands, the supportive community that not only prays with words, but prays by touch as well. So some of that kind of dimension that I think has a kind of healing function that I would simply explain as drawing on dimensions of our own capacity for self-healing and our own need for the kind of healing that comes from having a loving, supporting community in which you can bring out certain kinds of distresses that you may have been concealing and have that affirmed and in a kind of healing and reconciling way. Now, in the section on rites of healing in this particular book, which I mentioned yesterday, I focus particularly on healing from various kinds of physical and social violence. Now, that's certainly not the only kind of healing that we might be concerned about, but it's a very large area that tends to be rather disregarded in much of our society. I talked yesterday about a seminarian who was almost finishing and was about to be ordained, and who was, her apartment was broken in at night, and she was raped, and she had this enormous need to sort of tell her bishop, and my guess was that what she really wanted was healing from her bishop, but she didn't even know how to express that. So those kinds of things, which are typically dealt with by giving the person involved the sense that they have been degraded and shamed, and often people even keep that within them for a long time. They don't feel like they can tell anybody and so on. I think are part of those areas where one needs healing liturgy. So the chapter starts out talking about, it has a kind of a general, you might say, healing liturgy that focuses on a supportive community of laying out of hands and praying and so on around someone who simply might feel depressed and backache and all those kind of things that one doesn't quite even know where the distress comes from. And then there's various kinds of healing rites from different kinds I think where physical and social violence really intersect, such as domestic violence, incest, rape, some of those kind of things that we have begun to recognize and deal with in a social way, with shelters and hotlines and all those kind of things. But I think we've only begun to even imagine this other dimension of a prayer healing community that might gather around those kinds of violence. I have some other kinds of things in here, such as rededication of a house after burglary. I don't know, any of you ever had your house burgled? How many of you ever had somebody break into your house? You live in quiet parts of the country, obviously. I mean, there's some people whose house has been broken three or four times in the city. Well, I think there's a sense that when somebody breaks in your house, that it's not just that they happen to steal your stereo. There's a sense that your space has been violated. what was intended to be a place of safety has become a place of danger. It's almost like the extension of your own. It's a bit like having your own body violated with mugging or something like that. But there's kind of extension of that, and having the your home, the place of safety, sort of violated. So I thought of that as a healing liturgy, of healings from abortion, miscarriage, and so on. Again, abortion is a whole other area of enormous social controversy in our society. And a lot of the social controversy seems to miss the point. It tends to assume, on the one hand, that I mean, it sort of doesn't grasp the fact that anybody who wants an abortion has, in a sense, already had their choice taken away from them. I mean, nobody, in fact, chooses to have an abortion. What you would choose is to be able to choose to have a child or not have a child when you wish to have that. You've, in a sense, already lost your freedom if you find yourself pregnant contrary to your will. So there's already a kind of violence there where people's, what should be the situation that we would be working toward, which is that women really are able, and men and women together, are really able to become responsible ethical agents of their own reproduction, rather than being sort of the victims of all kinds of ignorance and social forces that find them pregnant unexpectedly, unwillingly, and in situations where they're not really capable for various reasons of bearing and raising this child. And so I think that the people who've been promoting legal abortions have tended to sort of say, well, you know, that's nothing. You know, anybody ought to have that available, and completely ignore the kind of pain and grieving that should be certainly a part of that, even if you accept that in certain situations people have to make. Nevertheless, it's always a decision between evils, and there is an appropriate kind of grieving and pain involved in that. And I think the pro-choice people have, in their effort to promote the availability of legal abortions, have tried to sort of assume that, well, there's just nothing to it, you know. So it seemed to me that one needed to think about that as a healing liturgy. Other kinds of social brokenness, such as divorce, it seems to me, is an area where the church has had, of course, enormous ambivalence, and needs to think about ways of, well, certainly reconciliation that might keep a couple together, but when it's very clear that this couple is needs to get a divorce, that they simply are not going to be able to make a marriage, to have a kind of way of passing through that with some kind of reconciliation, and certainly if their children are involved, being able to function with each other as friends and co-parents of that child, even if they are no longer living together as man and wife, and so on. So all that kind of dimension of divorce, it seems to me, needs the possibility of some kind of healing and reconciling and forgiving liturgy, a liturgy of forgiveness in which the couple would, in a certain sense, forgive each other and be able to move on to some new kind of relationship. Rather, as what I think often happens, that people are just still playing all kinds of games of hostility with each other after the divorce. And of course, children often become the victims of that. So I think a very powerful ritual of divorce that was done by a friend of mine in Montreal, who is going through a divorce herself. And it envisions the husband and wife, and in this case children, in effect, all being able to participate and kind of forgive each other and move to some kind of new ability to function with each other post-divorce. So those are some of the ideas. Maybe I'll just describe one of these so you get some idea of what they might look like. Does all this mystify you? Have you ever, any of you ever done anything of this kind? Yeah? Let me describe my rededication of a house after burglary or other violence. Let me say that this book is kind of a composite, and it's, needless to say, not intended to be kind of a prayer book where people just kind of open up and say, well, here's the, you know, standard liturgy for rededication of a house after violence. But rather, it's intended to give a variety of ideas for a community to write their own liturgy. In other words, it's intended to really invite you or any other community that wants to do a kind of liturgy to become your own liturgies and to write the kind of liturgy or the kind of worship service that's appropriate this or that particular situation, because every situation of this kind would be very particular, and it would need to be written, in a sense, for that particular occasion. So these are intended to be a kind of collection of ideas to spark people's imagination. Some of these ideas are simply sketched out by myself. Some of them were rather developed liturgies that were actually done by other people, and I've essentially gotten them to contribute that liturgy to this book. In other cases, people have simply sketched out something that they would like to do, but they haven't actually done it. So it's a, in that sense, a collection of resources in which many people have contributed. This particular one I wrote, but I wrote with certain kinds of ideas in mind. One idea that I drew on is a very ancient idea that came from my memories of studying ancient anthropology and so on. And I remember that when people in early societies were going to found a city, they had a ritual of plowing a circle around that city and dropping grain in it and so on. And that was intended to form a kind of a sacred circle around that city that protected it and gave it a holiness, in effect, and of course city walls and so on were all connected with that. I think of this liturgy of rededicating a house after burglary in a sense as a kind of redrawing of that sacred circle of protection that has been violated. So I say this: the ritual begins with persons who live in the house standing in front of it, surrounded by friends. An opening statement is made by one or several of those who live in the house. And this is what I imagine somebody like this might say, something like this: "This house is our home, it's the place of our rest and our security. We have looked forward to return to this house many times to find the place where we relax, where we seek shelter and security. And this, our home, has been violated. Instead of a place of security and peace, it has become a place of fear. Its integrity has been broken, its peace has been shattered. And so we now start up with fear when we hear unexpected noises, wondering if it's another assault." And then I suggest some details of the burglary and its effects on the various members of the household might then be described. In other words, people in the household might describe how the house had been broken into and how they now felt and so on. So it would start out with people kind of sharing that in front of the house. And then Isaiah 24, 4-12 is read responsively by two persons, while others moan softly. So there's kind of a keening aspect of this. You know what keening is? Anybody heard of keening? Keening, well, this in funerals and so on, in many societies, you have almost a kind of chorus of people who simply kind of moan in a kind of chant. So I would suggest people kind of moaning in a chanting way, and then two people reading Isaiah 24, 4-12, and part of that goes something like this: "The city of chaos is broken down. Every house is shut up so that none can enter. Desolation is left in the city. The city gates are battered into ruins." And so some of those kind of ideas that come from Isaiah. And then members of the household say together, "We will not succumb to fear. Holy wisdom is our strength and our protection. We will," and by the way, I use wisdom in here as, of course, a biblical image of God that combines certainly God the Father, but also God's wisdom as a female personification. So I intend it as a kind of gender-inclusive word for God. "Holy wisdom is our strength and our protection. We will once more make this house into a home, into a place of security and peace and love. We will go on living here, drawing strength and protection from our mutual love." And then, led by household members, the group then encircles the house. Now, if you live in an apartment, this might be a little hard to do, but you can adapt. You're free. You can do this if you have a freestanding home. If you have an apartment, as I said, you might have to just partly do this. The group that encircles the house, some bearing fragrant branches, and one swinging a pot of incense. In other words, I think we need to appeal to our eyes and our nose, ears, senses. And certainly incense and perfume has been one of the ways in which traditional liturgy has appealed to the sense of smell. So he was swinging a pot of incense. The group circles the house, and a pointed stick traces a furrow around the house, and a trail of grain is left in the furrow to symbolize the circle of life. That's where I sort of draw on the ancient notion of the circle of protection around a city. The group then stops at various points around the house. In other words, you might stop at different windows and doors and say, wisdom is our security and our protection. We will not be afraid. The group then enters the house, and each door and window in the house is sprinkled with some leaves from the fragrant branches. Might have a little cleanup here afterwards, but we won't worry about that. The group says, let this door or window no longer be a place where fear prowls. Let us look out at pleasant vistas and beckon in sweet breezes and welcome guests. And the ritual concludes with the group gathering around the dining room table. The incense pot is put in the center, the branches and vases all around. And the group joins hands and says, in the power of holy wisdom, we join together to be strength and protection for one another. Let that power and strength flow from hand to hand, from touch to touch, from glance to glance, from word to word. And let us bind up the wounds of this house and bind up each other's wound, and peace and love be with us all, everyone. So that's the kind of, you might say, group liturgy, and you might say the community for that is sort of the relevant community. It's the immediate people who live in that house, plus, you know, a circle of friends and so on. Okay, what I would like to suggest is that some of you might begin to name areas where you might, where you have experienced some kind of area of crisis, you might say unhealed wounds. And where you might find it appropriate, where you might like to write such a healing liturgy for yourself or in the context of a community of supportive people. Is there anybody that has any such ideas? Some kind of area of your own life where you might feel the need for some kind of supportive liturgy? Your healing liturgy. Yeah. One of the things that I printed in here, and was a very, very moving thing, was a healing liturgy that came from a seminarian who had been sexually abused as a child by her father, but sort of, you might say, psychologically abused by her mother as well. I mean, the mother sort of never could quite acknowledge what the father was doing, but she sort of treated the child as though she was evil. So there was a kind of double battery and very ambivalent messages, because the sexual abuse by the father was, in a sense, a kind of ambivalent love, whereas the battering from the mother was a kind of rejection of her as evil and so on. And so she had kind of repressed all that for a long time, and then it kind of exploded in her second year of seminary, and she went through a lot of therapy and so on. And then as she was sort of getting to the point where she was beginning to be able to deal with it in terms of her work with the therapist and so on, she decided to do a healing liturgy for herself. And to me that was it was kind of an amazing example of how the therapy was very helpful, but the liturgy sort of carried it to another dimension. About that time, she discovered a black toy cat that she'd had as a child. And when she was feeling horrible about herself, she'd sort of creep into her room and she'd sort of stab this cat, pull its ears, and she had sort of made the cat didn't literally have a vagina, but she'd made one by stabbing it with a pencil, sort of reenacting her feelings of abuse and so on. And she found this cat in the attic. And so what she decided to do as a healing liturgy was a kind of very loving funeral for this toy cat. And she gathered, what I described in there was the liturgy she actually did. And she talks about how the healing aspect of that, maybe I'll just quickly read it, because I think it's such a, when I read this, I could hardly believe. See, the following ritual was developed by a female inset. Well, I just described all that. This is the order of celebration. First, the survivor, as she called herself, dug a grave in the woods. This was done at midnight. The cat's name was Midnight. So she dug a grave in the woods.
And she worked alone, giving her time to reflect and to work up a sweat while she dug this grave. The liturgy took place at midnight. The mourners arrived, one with a cross, another with a bowl of water, and others with flowers or bunches of clover. Some of them were wearing black coats and hats, so there was a kind of somewhat joking reference to, you know, funerals where people wear black. And so. The mourners included her therapist and the people who had been her close supporters during her recent struggle. The therapist read Psalm 27. Midnight, the cat lay in her shoebox casket, and all could see how battered and torn she was. Another friend, who was also an incest victim, read the 10th reading from the Tao Te Ching. That's a Chinese scripture on newness, birth, birthing, and wholeness. The survivor then gave a eulogy for midnight. She reflected on many other women who are living through dark experiences that needed to be buried. Homeless women, battered women, rape victims, other incest victims. She reflected on the terror which so many women live their lives and how we need to bury that terror. She committed herself to work for the cause of these women. And then midnight was interred in the grave, and all participated in healing, heaping earth over the box. Then the survivor was baptized. The whole community sort of did a kind of communal baptism. The bowl of water was passed from hand to hand. As each person sprinkled her with water, they made statements of affirmation and support. An E.E. Cummings poem was read, "I thank you, God, for this most amazing day." And then she talks about how that liturgy, in effect, gave a kind of closure to one stage of her effort to deal with this experience. Now, needless to say, that would not be a liturgy that anybody else could do exactly. It was very particular to that experience. But I think it's a very powerful example of how people can take their own particular experience and really use it in that way. Anybody else have some kinds of things they might be concerned about? They would. I mean, what I was hoping to work on in tomorrow's session is precisely those rites of passage, which enable us to visualize leaving one stage of life and going forward to another. Yesterday I mentioned that there's a menopause liturgy, which I think of as a rite of passage. And we adapted that to hysterectomy liturgy, which in a sense was both healing and a rite of passage. Yeah, I would think of a rite of passage as essentially moving from one state of life to another. Whereas I think a healing liturgy, it has more the sense of healing from some kind of brokenness of life. There are points in which those intermix, but I would distinguish them in the sense of rite of passage is kind of a normal transition from one state to another, but one where we often don't have a sense of being able to visualize not only giving up the one stage of life, but visualize the new possibilities of the new stage of life. I think of retirement as a very important area where we have, particularly for men, very poor rites of passage. The typical way in which men, and of course increasingly as women have full work careers, this may affect women too, but the typical ritual for a man who's worked whatever, 40 years in a company or something, is that he has a retirement party, and he's, given the gold watch and so on, and everybody, there's a little eulogy for what he's done, but no way to visualize a new state of life that he's going into. And I think the effects of that are rapid decline and death for retired men. Because in a sense, there's no kind of sense that they're passing into a new positive stage of life. They're just in a kind of holding pattern until they die, is really what we're saying to people. So, I think working on good retirement liturgy is a very important area. Well,
I think it works, as I said, by drawing on what I call ordinary grace. Not by I'm not talking miracles. I'm talking about being able to mobilize, in a sense, your own deeper courage and gather around you the support community. And out of that, I think comes a kind of healing that is an ordinary human experience. We're not talking about miracles. That enables you to do certain things that not being able to communicate those fears and so on keeps you immobilized. So I mean, it works to the extent that the liturgy is able to kind of tap into and express those kind of processes. Yeah.
After you have either been violated of your body, or after you've had an abortion, or after your house has been burglarized, how long between the time of violation and the time of healing? Obviously, you can't do it the next day or even the next week. You have to go through a grieving process in order to come to the state of mind that you need to be healed of this. Is there a general length of time, or how would one know what time is best for them?
Yeah. Well, I think, first of all, if people have the imagination that such a thing is possible, I mean, generally speaking, we don't even have the sense that such a thing is possible, so that people go on endlessly grieving because there's no way of giving a kind of closure to it. I was speaking the first week I was here to one of the staff members who'd been raped when she was 20, and she'd gone through 10 years of feeling depressed. It was kind of there was a little part of her that was depressed, and she'd sort of fall into this part of her that was depressed that came from that experience. And then she gradually thought that she'd gotten out of that, and then her house was broken into, and there was an attempted rape of her daughter, which they were able to fight off. But she found that this attack on her daughter threw her right back into the depression that had never really been healed. So I think that what I'm saying is that if we had the sense that we could do healing liturgy, that would provide a kind of possibility which isn't even there when we just think, well, we just have to cope with having been raped. If one thinks, well, this is a possibility, then in a sense you do it at the point when you're ready to do it. I mean, I think that my guess is that one would be ready to do it when you work through a certain...
When you're ready to drop the egg and say it's baggy.
Yeah, when you kind of work through some of the depression a little bit, and that the liturgy would work as a kind of way of giving a sort of... a kind of closure and a kind of deeper way of expressing a certain kind of passage to another state of life. That was certainly the case with the liturgy for the incest victim. I mean, she basically bottled that up for 20 years, and then she sort of worked it through with the therapist. But simply talking about, there was a sense that which that was not enough. And so the liturgy, in a sense, functioned to tap into sort of some deeper levels of experience, but also to give a kind of closure to the therapy. So my guess is, as I said, if these kind of things became culturally available, people would sort of know at the point when they were ready to do it. Yeah.
It's supposed to be free to have it done, and the funeral is supposed to be closure, but I don't think that it is. And I think that our family for the last 7 years has not ever really resolved that loss, that grief, that death. It hasn't been closure.
Yeah.
In the whole family. And there's an incident recently that brought it all to the fore again, and everybody's percolating up with, we've got to sit down together and somehow resolve this. And I think
Maybe a kind of anniversary the next year or something like that, where people would, where the family would gather. Yeah. Yeah. I think any kind of violence, one is kind of numb, and then one starts to deal with it, and that the liturgy, the kind of reconciliation liturgy, would most appropriately come at a sort of, so there's a third stage or something like that, or you might have several stages of ritualizing this kind of thing. I don't know. I haven't heard about healing of memory, so that's an interesting idea. What did you hear about?
The Jesuits, they're very involved in healing of memory, killing of the dying, and it's a process like that. Although it tends to be, I think, more one-on-one in terms of the counseling situation, other than the
liturgical framework. Yeah. Yeah, that's certainly we're talking of putting closure to certain kinds of painful memories, in a sense, yeah?
For me, the last 15 years of his life, this man drank a fifth of vodka a day. And part of the problem was that he had a son who was, at this point, 30 years old and his mentally retarded. And actually, the wife, he and the wife were separated, not divorced. And one of the things that I try to work on with that, and I've done this before, is that I gathered just the end of the family at the horse parade on the day prior to the service. And I asked them to share something good about Allah with Allah.
Mm-hmm.
And the three daughters, there were two daughters were there, and a 30-year-old son was there, and the widow was there. And so they started sharing these things.
That's a kind of example of certain kinds of ways of gathering a healing and support community, in effect drawing out a capacity to feel that had not been available.
Martin Kelsey, of course, has written a book on that.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of... You had another...
Well, yeah, I'm interested about how to meet.
Yeah.
And how to sort of make it more of a congregational event. How do you do that with somebody who's dealing with
it? Well, I don't think that you can do it with every kind of healing. I think there's appropriate communities. And I'm talking about this in communities, but I think there are appropriate levels of community. And the congregation may not always be the appropriate community, but it depends on the congregation. I mean, there's a very supportive, highly, kind of intentional, but just a local Methodist church. It's not some special
odd church in Evanston, and they had a woman who was raped from their congregation, and so they had a healing liturgy for her. So, I mean, there's some congregations that can do this because they are those kind of communities, but it's not, you know, it's not that easy in most congregations, precisely because they're not that supportive communities.
Or how then do healing education in congregations,
yeah,
so people know about the...
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think it's appropriate to think of congregations as a big community, but composed of many sub-communities. And it's possible to have smaller communities within this that gather around particular events.
Okay.